Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and I want to thank you for tuning in. Off Camera is the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. Well, that's what I usually do, but this episode is a little different. I thought it might be kind of fun, since we've been doing this for a while, to switch things up a bit and give you all a peek behind the scenes here at Off Camera. I've enlisted my friend Chris Moore, who you may know from the shows he's created, like Project Greenlight in the Chair, or from movies he's produced, like Good Will Hunting, American Pie, and The Adjustment Bureau. Chris is going to sit in my chair and focus his curious brain on this show. Call it the off-camera show about off-camera, if you will. So I'm in the hot seat this time, and Chris has come up with some questions that pique his curiosity. So let's see what happens. Pull up a chair and listen in.
All right, Sam.
Well, here I am over in this chair.
How's it feel?
How did that happen?
I took it over. I decided it was time for you guys to talk about off camera.
Well, you know, I had you on the show in when? Like last year, year before?
Yep, last year.
And it was a great conversation. I've known you a long time. And so, you know, switching positions and doing this, I feel like it's kind of natural.
Well, I will say that I was so honored and, you know, happy to come here and talk to you, because I do think what you do and what this off-camera project is really cool. And I think, having been around almost just socially at the beginning when you were thinking about doing it, I found that it came from such an honest place of you're just so tired of these, you know, soundbite specific interviews, and there's people out there in the world that you'd really like to know a lot more about, and nobody ever gives them a chance to ever talk in depth in that way.
That's right.
And so I was really impressed by that. I will say the other thing is that I have heard in social situations probably 2,000 ideas that people have, and they talk about it and you hear about it and you wonder, are they pitching me this idea? Is this something that they're just talking about to see if somebody else likes it? What's going to happen? And you actually did it. Like, we're here in a building, you're doing it. I think this will be, what, episode 49, 50, something like that?
This will be, I think, 51. We've done 50 of these.
50, yeah. Right? Well, I just got to tell you, in this town, that's impressive. I mean that honestly. Like, it's, people do not go out and do what they say they're going to do very often. And I think it's a quality that needs to be celebrated. So I'm happy to be here and try to get you to talk about yourself. You never do, which is a great skill.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think that's true. I think that I know a million people who say they're writers or say they're directors, and it's, I've been in that situation where I've had an idea that was sure it was going to go, and I talked about it, and then for some reason it fell through. And the next time you see that person, you almost feel like, why did I even mention it?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that is true in this town and in this industry. If you just do what you say you're going to do, or just follow through, you're already ahead of 90% of the people.
99, possibly.
Yeah.
But I also think the core idea was really interesting, of giving people a chance to have a good interview, to have a long interview. You know, I'm old, so, you know, I can remember when Playboy used to do it. I don't know that anyone would open a Playboy now due to the weirdness of that business. And you'd have these big pieces in New Yorker and other things where you could really get to know somebody. You know, now it just never happens, and it feels like everybody's shilling for something. And that's the thing I also really like about off camera is, you know, in some ways you don't really time it like the talk shows or, you know, Kimmel or those guys, to them trying to push something. They're
right
there to just talk about themselves, and they're there to talk about whatever their process, their actors, writers, musicians, whatever. And I just find it, anyway, I think it's great. So I'm grateful for you to do it. I think everybody should pay attention and watch it. And I would love to know, back at that inspiration moment, were you, you know, angry about not being able to read stuff and learn about people? Or was it more, this is a business opportunity that I could take advantage of? It felt much more personal when we first talked about it.
Well, I'll tell you several things. Number one, you say the non-agenda thing.
Yeah.
I'm lucky enough that I started out a long time ago taking pictures, and that grew into taking pictures of very famous people for very big magazines, and I've had a very, very long and lucky career doing that. So when I started the show, I was able to get people on through those relationships.
Right.
I've pretty much gone through my Rolodex at this point. but
obvious by the fact that I'm the one sitting here.
Letterman was busy.
Yeah, exactly.
Charlie Rose didn't pick up my call, yeah. And Conan actually egged my house. So here you are. No, but I think that we discovered something in those early ones. I think it was Robert Downey, and he was the fifth one we ever did. And he came over to my little studio before we were here, and the first thing he said was, "I'm doing you such a big favor," like in a, you know, his sarcastic, joking way. And he walked in like he was, you know.
Right.
But the first thing he said when he sat down was, "You know what? It's so great that we're not here selling soap, and right. I can just talk. I never get to do that." And a light bulb went on for me that, like, you know, maybe all these people that we think we know and we see on television all the time, we see them in movies, we see them on talk shows, maybe they're walking around feeling like I never really get to talk like a craftsman or talk like an artist or talk like a creative person. Right. I'm sort of always either selling something or doing some agenda, right? And now, as we go on, it is harder. We do have to time these things a little bit to projects because it's sort of how the business works. But when we get sort of that situation where it all lines up and someone comes in and they don't feel like they have an agenda, it is different, you know? And that's how it started for me, I think. I think also being a photographer, I am always fighting for a really authentic portrait of somebody. Because when I see a really great portrait, I'm blown away. Like when I see, you know, say Richard Avedon's picture of Truman Capote, or you know, Annie Leibovitz's portrait of Keith Haring, or something where it's like the inside and the outside match up, and aesthetically it all gives you a window into who you think this person is. And as a photographer who shoots people, that should always be the goal, I think, is to try to really shed some really insightful light on somebody. Yeah. But I started noticing 10 or 15 years into doing it that oftentimes I remember the experience of the day more than, you know, that was to me the true experience was getting to know that person and connecting with them.
Right.
And the photograph was secondary, and the better I connected, the better picture I made.
Right.
And hopefully, you know, that's in the viewer's eye if they saw the picture and said, "I connect with that person." But I started thinking, well, could a portrait be more than, you know, just a picture? And I think that what Off Camera was essentially, in my mind, when it started, was a really intricate, in-depth portrait of somebody.
That's a great way to put it, yeah. You also have done some people who I didn't know a lot about, who were fascinating, and I think that's also part of your, I don't know, part of the success is how do you pick these people, or what is it? It doesn't, like I said, because it's not solely based on someone's out promoting something, you're also not doing it daily.
Right.
You get a chance to sort of pick. Obviously, some of it is who will do it.
Right.
I can admit that, right? But I think some of it is also, you use the word craft sometimes. And it feels like a lot of the people you pick actually have a craft, whatever, and they believe in it and they really want to be good at it. But are there other insights or things about how somebody becomes a target for Off Camera?
Well, the first thing is just personal interest. And if, you know, and my interests are so wide ranging that if I target in on somebody and just say, "God, I just love their work," then that person goes to the top of the list, you know? But an unexpected benefit of doing this has been that, yeah, we can't get everybody all the time. And sometimes we have to work on people for 2 years to get them in.
Right.
When they like the idea, you know, the eventuality is, yes, I'll do it. But then actually finding the time and, you know, it takes a while. So, for instance, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he was one of the first guys I ever told about the idea because we were just cooking it up and I went and photographed him for a magazine and I told him, he said, "Oh, it's great, I'll do it." And then 2.5 years later, we finally got him in the chair. But an unexpected benefit has been to be able to be offered somebody or have someone come on my radar and have it start to be a conversation around the office. I go, "Can this person, what you think this would be a good person to do on the show?" And then you get to start digging into their work. And I find that when I dig into someone's work, a lot of the times I'm completely surprised, like, how did I miss this person?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the other factor is, can someone handle an hour of self-reflection and self-awareness, because our best guests are the ones that are most self-aware. Yeah. And the ones who really have either struggled or examined their career in such ways, or really want to grow as an artist throughout their career. Right. Those people are the most interesting, because they're constantly challenging their perceptions or pushing up against what they think is the limit of, and I think a guy like Ethan Hawke is a great example. He's one of our favorite interviews because he constantly, whenever he gets comfortable, he seems to try something else and often gets completely slammed for it. Like, he wrote a book and then found out how much people don't like when you get out of your lane, and, yeah, and had to endure some terrible criticism. But in the end, he said, look, I'd rather have written the book, no matter what people say, than never try to write a book.
Right.
And to me, that's the kind of artist we want to hear, like curious, restless creatives that don't want to just rest on their laurels.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about when you were just saying that is that you also have made documentaries.
Yes.
And in some ways, documentaries, there's a music one with Dylan and his music, there's others that you've been part of, that it's also a little bit of a portraiture. Do you find in this scenario, like in the different scenarios where you investigate people,
right,
so, you know, you're doing a still portrait, that has its limits, you talked about that a little bit, but then you have the talk show where you're here and we're doing this conversation together, I'm sure that you've found its boundaries and lines, having done 50 of them. But you've also done these documentaries, and I don't think a lot of people know that about you, that, you know, you get behind these projects, and a lot of them, even though you attach great people to them over time, are driven by you. And it feels like some of them come from this place of a similar, of really trying to get to know people and really trying to share who these artists really are. Is that a fair summary?
Totally. And I think that, you know, the documentary is the classic example of the lone wolf. You know, in filmmaking, if you want to really sort of strike out on your own and go into that dark place, and documentary is the way to go, because there's never any money, and you're chasing a story that maybe only you know or you sense might be there, and you don't have, for good and for bad reasons, you don't have executive producers and you don't have people behind the scenes sort of supporting you. But I think documentaries are absolutely a portrait, and I think that what the most fascinating documentaries to me are when I'm in a room I wouldn't normally get to be in.
Right.
And I get to see a process. And if you look at the films I have made, they are very much along these same lines of the creative process. And I think, if anything, that probably is indicative of my desire to be in this creative world of people making things and wanting to feel like I belong and wanting to feel like I can hold my own in those rooms,
right,
you know? And music is such a big thing for me, and yet growing up, even playing in bands and everything, I don't think I ever really felt like I was as good or as worthy of that kind of thing, and that, you know, as you get older, you find out that's all in your head, you know, and that's for other people to judge. But I think through making documentaries and through doing a whole bunch of commercial work that was documentary based, and then doing this show, I do find out that I'm constantly seeking connections with creative people, and I, you know, some of it is probably selfishly just trying to find some calm or some reassurance that I'm doing it right, or I'm
right.
You know what I mean? And I think that documentary thing, it's different though than this. And I think a lot about terms. Like, I don't like to call this an interview. I don't like to call it a talk show. Although it's both of those.
I'm sorry.
Things. No, it's both of those things, right? Of course it is.
Yeah.
But around the office, we always try to use the word conversation.
Right.
I'm very sensitive of the idea that by doing off camera, I've become part of the media. Because I feel like off camera, if anything, has more in common with a documentary than it does with a variety-based talk show like a Letterman or a Charlie Rose even or something. And the goal with off camera originally was, can we make something that's working on a different level? It's entertaining, but is it making that connection so someone watching it can feel the same way I feel when I'm talking to somebody, you know, and Can I be inspired? Can I be educated? And if, you know, in a documentary, you're pursuing a story.
Right.
Right? And it sort of becomes like you have to prove your story in your documentary. You have to take a point of view.
Yeah.
Off camera is interesting because you may walk in with a point of view, but it can be totally changed in the course of an hour and there's no agenda.
Right.
You know? But I think it's seeking out that portraiture and that and trying to get to understand what makes someone tick. We keep trying to think of taglines for the show because we feel like on the podcast we need a tagline, you know, and the other day we came up with the show where we get to talk to creative, restless, iconic artists and find out what made them that way.
Yeah.
Because that's really what I'm interested in is how did you go from some kid that I knew at school in sixth grade, you know, flopping around in the sandbox to this, you know, this maker of art that can change people's perceptions or enlighten them or open up their viewpoint or you know, that's what gets me all the time.
Well, so let's just go with that right now on Sam Jones. So you're in the playground, you're in sixth grade, right? And because I would say it's even metaphorically so classic and traditional that you were behind the camera, whether documentary or photography, right? And now you're in front of it. That's a psychological change in your own life. So now you've obviously at some point, 50 episodes ago or whenever that happened, I'm gonna, you know, it's time for me to get out there. You're in the front of some of these documentaries, not necessarily in them, but you're the director and the piece. And I know, coming from a small town, for me, it's always hard to make that leap where, you know what? I can handle it. I'm gonna be fine up here. I see it. And so I would ask a two-part question of sort of, so way back, right, in your young time, you may not have been sixth grade or 6 years old, but at some point we realize creativity and other stuff is of interest to you and you're playing in bands, as you mentioned. I don't know if that's high school, college, post-college, but can you walk us through a little bit of that experience and then land at sitting in this chair?
Sure. And it's funny because I, just to go backwards into that, I think doing documentaries and commercials, you're interviewing somebody, but you're sitting behind the camera, and you can ask them something five times until you get the answer you want.
Right.
With this show, I felt like I had to be on camera because there's an authenticity to it that wouldn't exist anywhere else. If you're watching a show and someone asks a question, and the other person says, "Well, that's not right at all."
Right.
Okay, the person watching it goes, "Oh, this is real."
Yeah.
But growing up, I grew up in Fullerton, California, and Fullerton was the home of, I think, three very important things. Number one, the Fender Guitar Factory, which fed the music stores and pawn shops in the neighborhood, which created, number two, a big explosion of kids joining bands because instruments were super cheap. And number three, a ton of swimming pools because it's Southern California, it's warm. There was a lot of skateboarding going on, skateboard parks, kids playing in bands, and then kids making things around that.
Right.
For instance, with us, we had a skateboard scene, we had a ramp, and at one point we wanted to have a contest, so we had to make a flyer.
Right.
And then once we made the flyer and we had the contest, we wanted to like tell that story, so we made a little magazine.
Right.
And we gave it out to the kids, the other skater kids, like, this is our scene. And by doing that kind of stuff, you don't realize it at the time, but you're sort of putting your foot in every aspect of production, right? You're having an idea, you're sort of organizing a community, you're creating a marketing campaign around it, and then you're putting out a finished product of artwork.
Yeah.
And it gives you this taste, and then you're also performing. You're either skating or you're playing music. And so I think that growing up in the time I did, pre sort of video game obsession, and it was just this desire to make things to fill the time,
right,
you know, and to be creative. And so I was one of those kids that had way too much energy, and I always wanted to make things, and I always wanted to do things, and get people together to do them,
right,
you know, like whether it was, you know, egging a house or grabbing onto cars as they went by on our skateboards or more, something more serious like, you know, putting a band together and going out and playing a show. I think that those things were the bedrock of my personality because they satisfied me
more than anything else. And I think lucky for me, I also had parents that weren't completely interested in me. Right. I mean, they were interested in me to a certain extent, but in terms of how you're getting to school, how you're getting somewhere, you have
figure
a bike, you
right.
got friends with cars, you'll figure it out. You know, I don't think my parents ever came to any of my skateboard contests or any of my early band shows or anything.
Right.
And so it gave me sort of a independent streak.
Right.
You know, I wasn't the kid that was like, you know, the parents are shuffling them around to the band practice and
right.
taking them to meet their friend who works at the marketing department of the record company
right.
or something. I guess what I'm trying to say is that there was an early independent streak in me of, oh, I can make whatever I want, and I usually feel best when I make something. And I think if I look at that kid, I'm not doing anything that's that different today. Almost to my detriment sometimes, because I'm sure there's easier ways to earn money and easier ways to get things made than by having to build your own studio
right.
and, you know, create your own television show. I'm sure I could have gone out
right.
and pitched something and made it easier on myself, but there's a huge satisfaction in doing it this way.
So now you're doing it. You're 50 episodes in. I believe you've been picked up for another season in the television aspect. The podcasts are growing. Just magazine that goes along with it. Is it keep growing off camera? Is it keep growing Sam Jones?
Well, the off camera thing, I feel like, you know, you look at some of these people that have been doing it a long time, right? And not to compare myself, because I'm not, but people like Howard Stern or
right.
Charlie Rose or whoever right. that have done this for a long time, we are so at the beginning of this. I mean, if you have a daily show, you do 50 shows in 3 months' time.
Right.
You know, it's taken us 3 years' time to do it. So I want a much larger sample size. I feel like everything I learn in this thing is it moves at a slow pace because we don't do that many of these shows. I also feel like the world of podcasting is growing, and I'd like to see that audience grow along with us. And you know, we make a print magazine as well, which you know, because you were on the cover of one of them. And we feel we're just scratching the surface on that too. And it's kind of fun for me to have the anomaly of an actual print magazine
right.
in this day and age. But the TV show requires so much production and the podcast requires a certain amount of production that the magazine, I don't even think we've gone out and given it a chance and found distributors yet. And that's a big goal for us is to let more people stumble across this magazine and see the print aspect of it. Because another aspect of this show that people may not know if they just watch it or listen to it as a podcast is that we do a photo shoot with everybody
yeah.
that we sit in the chair with. And that's so fun for me because it is that initial idea of a complete portrait.
Right.
And at the beginning, we used to have this big debate, like, do we do the photo shoot first or do we do the interview first?
Right.
And the reason it's a big debate is because there's positives and negatives about each thing. Like, sometimes if I photograph someone first, they would get comfortable with me and I'd feel like I had a little history with them.
Right.
And then by the time we sit in the chair, we're pals.
Yeah.
But I also have this tendency to talk the whole time with somebody as I'm photographing them, because I want to enhance the comfort level on the
right.
photo shoot. And then we would sit down and it would feel fake.
Right, because like, you already talked about it.
Yeah, and I would find myself, you know, starting a question and go, oh, if I ask that in the photo shoot, I can't ask it
yeah.
here. And so now, you know, we pretty much sit down and talk first and then we go do the shoot. But it's been such an incredible thing for me as a photographer and a documentary maker to have them like to do both those things on the same day.
Yeah.
So to get back to your original question, I want more people to see this as this complete package. I like the idea that we only do each person once. Now I may be shooting myself in the foot to say that,
right.
but I like the idea that we make one portrait and that's the standing one of off camera for somebody.
Yeah.
And to me, it's interesting, even in an archival sense, to do 200 or 300 of these and then be able to look back and go, these things will live as a
yeah.
as an authentic portrait of these people.
Yeah, maybe you start over 10 years later.
Right.
You know, what's Robert Downey going to say 10 years from now when he walks in?
But, exactly. Now, if I'm still doing this in 10 years, I'll be surprised. But,
well,
but maybe not.
Less 3 years, you've only done 50, and you said you want to do 300. I can't quite do the math off my head, but I would say that's close.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that the more I do of them, the more I realize how much there is to learn and how much there is to talk about, and that you, like, it doesn't get old to me. It's completely exciting to me. But that being said, I've not stopped doing the other things I do at all. And like next week, I'm going to do a Vanity Fair job with Francis Ford Coppola. And I'm looking forward to that so much, to just do a pure photo shoot.
Right.
You know, for me, I think I realized one thing about myself, which is I'm never going to be the one thing guy.
Right.
And it confuses people. And it's funny because when I did the Wilco documentary, I used to read, you know, in Vanity Fair magazine, you open it up and in the beginning they have the contributors page.
Yeah.
And you read about some writer, some editor, some photographer.
Yeah.
And I used to read the photographer blurbs and they would say, oh, so-and-so is putting a book out and is having a show in Paris and is going hang gliding in the Andes or something. And my bio would be like, he's just taking a bunch of pictures, you know? And I wouldn't tell people that I was also like making fake radio shows in my garage or, you know, drawing cartoons or something.
Right.
But I thought, okay, I need to go out and do something else. Like this is acceptable. And it sort of seemed like part of the deal that you had to like have something else about right. yourself that you were doing. Whereas at the time, like, photography just took up all my time.
Right.
So I went out and I made the Wilco documentary, and that was a crazy chapter of my life. I put my own money into it, and it was like my film school. I didn't know what I was doing at all. I learned on the fly and everything. And as you know, the film was pretty well received
yeah.
and had a theatrical release.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the phone stopped ringing for photography. And I'd call my agent and I'd say, what's going on? I should be blowing up now. Like, all these people know who I am.
Right.
And she said, everyone thinks you've quit photography. And we're going to have to tell them you're still working. And that's when I sort of like one of those true things that I'm sure everyone else realized long before me. But this thing hit me, which was that people just expect you to stay in your lane.
Yeah.
You know, and then now it's one of the main things I talk about on this show with actors. And one of the first things I ask is, you know, what roadblocks do you run into when you try to go outside of the thing that you're known for?
Right.
I mean, I always cite the perfect example is Kramer. Like, there couldn't be a more perfect acting performance of someone embodying a role
right.
than Michael Richards being Kramer on yeah. Seinfeld. But thank God that thing went for like 9 seasons
because yeah.
he was so good at it that no one will let him out of that lane. But that happens to, I think, almost every actor, every director, and every musician on some level.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So fast forward to now, just had a conversation with my agent, and we looked at the schedule, and I realized, you know, I had to turn down a few jobs this year because of off-camera, and I did less photography, which is fine. But I asked my agent about it, and she goes, yeah, people think you're just doing off-camera and you're not doing other things, you know? And at a certain point, you go, okay, well, maybe the world's right. Maybe you can't do everything.
Right.
And that's my big struggle now. At the age I am and where I am, I've got kids in school. I got a really busy life. And focusing on things and making them great, it's tougher when you spread yourself into more things. So that's my struggle right now.
I really enjoy when you ask that question in the interviews on off camera about the changing lanes or doing other stuff. And you're right, Ethan Hawke was a great interview about that. One thing that I'll say is there's two types of changing lanes for performers and stuff. There's genre stuff, like you're a comedian and then you want to do a drama. You know, we had an experience, Matt Damon and Ben and I, with Good Will Hunting, where Robin Williams comes in, he's a big comedian, and he, you know, wins an Academy Award for doing arguably a dramatic part, right?
Right.
And he was so grateful and amazed by that experience that he could actually go out and sort of flex that muscle. But what I would say as a producer, we look at people as creative versus business, right? And the lanes are probably bigger. It's like the 405 going past you, right? There's one over here. And so like when, you know, another guy, you know, when Ben Affleck says, I'm gonna go direct a movie, I say, yeah, of course. You know, you wrote a movie, you star, you're an actor. Well, now you can go direct it. It's all creative. And I love listening to interviews where people's like, no, they're totally tight, like Kramer trying to do something else.
Yeah.
That's crazy. But what I would also say is it's even a bigger leap when you decide to go to the business side. When you decide you're going to fund it yourself. You decide you're going to produce it and figure out how to make money from the project that you're making. And I would say in off camera, you made that choice. You said to yourself, and you said in the Wilco documentary, you spent a little bit of, you know, you spent some of your own money. But again, that was a creative endeavor that you wanted to go do, and I'm sure at some point the band said yes, and you said, okay, let's go figure out how to do it, and you did it and made it a reality, but it wasn't an ongoing, I'm gonna start a business that I have to balance the budget and I have to figure out how it's gonna work. And I would say that for me, when I hear the changing lanes things, that's always a big one, because it's a natural thing when you become talented and you have some success that you also then have projects you care about that you want to get off the ground, which requires a business side of your brain. Whereas again, me being the totally, you know, non-intellectual producer, to me, the creative side of your brain can be all creative, like writer, director, musician. You know, I'm always amazed when an actor sits down at the piano and can play the shit out of a thing, or
yeah,
you know, start singing. And you see it sometimes with guys like Will Ferrell and other people, like he's a comedian, and then all of a sudden he can do other stuff. You know, Hugh Jackman, I mean, he's out there doing a giant sing, right, dance song, and he's also Wolverine, right? But somehow in my mind, right, that still is a lane. It may not be the same size lane that your actors and your, but to then jump over completely the hill and say, holy shit, now I'm gonna go over here and become the business guy. And I would say that I've been very impressed, having been more on that side, that you as a producer, you and your partner as business people have made this an ongoing business. You've figured out the economics, you've taken ownership, you're using multiple distribution platforms right now. You're making that decision about how we distribute it. You know, it's not DirecTV, it's right, not your podcast people, it's not some big, you know, magazine publisher. It's you guys. How has that been for you, sort of, you know, flipping to that other side and sort of really being the quote unquote businessman of this creative endeavor?
You know, God, that is it's such a great way to describe like that big lane. And I think the business thing for me comes out of the need to get it done, like to see something so clearly. I mean, I think when you're a true creative, you see something really clearly. And once, like, that's the hardest part to be creative, right, is the idea. Once you get the idea and it comes into shape in your mind and you can pre-visualize it, then it's just a problem to solve. Some people say, okay, I got this great idea. Here's my script, I wrote it. And then they go out and they find a problem solver studio who can just give them the money and do it, right?
Yeah.
And as a photographer, it's, once you see it in your head, it's telling your crew and everything how to place things and the light and all this stuff so that the thing you see in your head becomes, it's that problem solving thing. But I think for me with this show and with the documentaries to some extent, I don't want to wait for someone else to see the idea or validate the idea. And unlike a picture where you can go take it and then you can go see and then the person goes see and you're seeing the same thing, pitching an idea is very different, because you can pitch an idea and you can pitch it to three people in the room and each one will have a different idea of what that looks like.
Right.
So with off camera, I think I want it to look a certain way and I want it to be just like the thing in my head. And I knew if I went out and started pitching it, no one was gonna do the black and white thing. Right. We haven't even talked about that, but like no one was gonna pay for the black and white thing. And I just thought, okay, I'll just make it. And then we'll figure out the other stuff. And that becomes the necessity. Like first you make it and then you figure it out. And so it's been a huge education to have to sort of set up the business structure of things. And I did, I brought on a business partner who, funny enough, is someone who was sort of by default the business partner, because when my kids got into preschool, and we started meeting all these new parents. I think preschool is the time when all of a sudden you get a bunch of new friends.
Yeah, that's true.
And, yeah, and then it happens again in school, and that's maybe your last time as adults when you make new friends in mass, right?
Yeah.
So all the moms were going out and doing like these crafting projects, or they'd go out and have, you know, wine night or whatever, and the dads weren't. And a couple of the moms were like, you need to get the dads together, you know? And then someone put together a dad's night and it was a bowling night. It's like, can we just all say the word man cave for an hour while we're bowling and make the cliche complete, you know, while drinking like Michelob or something?
Right, exactly.
It was, and no one really likes to bowl,
right,
but this was what was organized.
Right.
The guys will like a bowling night. So a couple guys at the school and me put together a basketball league. And, you know, it started out with like 17 dads and they all went and, you know, two Achilles popped within the first week, and a hamstring went, and it weeded down to the guys that actually could play a little basketball. But it also started out as a social thing where you'd play the basketball, and then you'd go to the bar, and everyone would order food and drink and talk and get to know each other. And after about 2 months of that, the wives started resenting the whole idea that their husbands were going out and getting drunk on a Tuesday night. And the basketball stayed, but the guys started dropping off. You know, it just ended up myself and Crawford, my business partner, and we'd be the only ones after basketball. We have really great wives, and they were like, "We don't care, go socialize." So we'd end up at the bar, and that was when I was starting off camera, and I'm a big talker, so I would just tell Crawford about the show. And eventually he just said, "Look, I want to be a part of this thing." And so it wasn't like I went out intentionally to find a business partner, but I found someone who was incredibly just nuanced at his ability to sort of listen and sort of figure out the structure of things, who also has a business background, which I don't. And, you know, decided to take on this thing as a labor of love. And so he's been a giant help to it. But also, I think that we got lucky on a few things, which every story.
Yeah, that's some luck.
Every story has some luck. And the big luck for us was that DirecTV saw what we were doing and didn't ask us to change it. They just thought it was cool. And so we made a licensing deal with them rather than a producing deal, so that we basically get to make a finished show and give it to them, which is unprecedented in television, I think, in a lot of ways. And the most beautiful thing about that is that they honor not the letter of the contract, but also the spirit. They've never been here. Like, they are so cool, they've never showed up here. And that part is amazing. The only times that I get together with them is socially or over a meeting down at the DirecTV building, but they've never been here. And they pretty much let us do what we want. And for me, that's the biggest victory of this show, is that it went from an idea to an actual thing without changing that much in the process. And that, when I stop and think about it, that's the thing that I can't believe, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, the business side of things, learning about podcasting, it's a constant moving target to try to figure out how do we grow that audience and how do we get people to find out about us. And that's been an education that's been really fun. I've become a big podcast fan. I mean, I was always an NPR guy, but since doing this, it's really piqued my interest to go listen to a bunch of things I normally wouldn't.
Have you at least enjoyed the fact that you've gotten to be able to protect it? Are you at this point where you find like, look, I went to that other side, I took a certain amount of risk, I created this business scenario, and it's actually really delivered for me? Are you enjoying sort of the fact that it's still going on and you still have this good relationship with DirecTV and you still are creating these different pieces, podcasts, magazines, whatever?
Completely. I mean, that's the thing that, like, you know, we can all get in our own ruts and say, oh, this isn't working, or this is a struggle and why aren't we here? But at the end of the day, I do know that whether this thing passes or fails eventually, whether it, you know, gets more successful or whatever, it won't be because I took someone else's advice. Like, I think that it would be horrible to have listened to a bunch of advice from somebody and then have the show fail. And then you always wonder, did it fail because I wasn't good enough at it? Or did it fail because I didn't trust my gut enough and didn't do things the way I thought? And I think that's a question that, I mean, guy, you look at any film director that has a big, you know, sort of body of work, no one gets out unscathed.
Right.
You know, there's no one that sits at the top of the Rotten Tomato meter with every movie, right?
Yeah.
And I would bet a lot of money that if you talk to those directors on some of their bigger failures, you would find a lot of stories where they maybe didn't trust their gut, or maybe they got talked into a casting decision that didn't seem right, or the studio brought in someone to rewrite, and when the rewrite came back, everyone loved it but them, so they decided, well, maybe I'm wrong on this one.
Right.
And maybe they were, but they'll never know for sure. And we don't, as creative people that do big collaborative endeavors, we don't get the opportunity very often to sort of like see our vision through.
Right.
And this show is small enough that gets to happen. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's like if you're a painter, you're not getting a room full of people in Hollywood to tell you that that shade of green is wrong or right. whatever. And I think painters live or die by, you know, whether or not they're talented and whether or not they, you know, all those other factors, but it's not because someone else is advising them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when all this is done and I can look back and say, you know, it was the success it was or reached whatever level, it will be for better or for worse based on our own merits,
right.
you know? And that's something I don't think that I will ever take for granted. And the fact that we get to broadcast it and people get to see it, that's amazing to me.
Two things come out of that answer that, and I'm glad you get to enjoy it. I asked the question partly because I'm old and I hate it when people don't stop because the business moves so fast. There's so many things happening that a lot of times you don't stop even for a day. Just say, you know, this is pretty cool. Like this, we get to do this and I
right.
accomplished this and you get a moment to it. So I'm glad you're enjoying it and keeping your perspective. The two other questions that popped out at me from that answer, one was you talked about if we fail, right? So some people argue you're at episode 51, you've done it a few years, you've
right.
done whatever. It's already clear you didn't fail, right? But one of the questions I would have is, well, then how are you defining success?
Right. Well, look, we're in an age now where, you know, as independent artists, whether you're a filmmaker or a musician or a photographer or a director, there doesn't seem to be the same safety pool of income in the entire entertainment business.
Right.
And you see this all the time where people can have 1 year where their career blows up in this sort of social media, internet world,
yeah.
and then that's it. And for me, I guess I define success and failure by, can I keep doing what I'm doing at a level that I can support my family
right.
and have that career? I guess for me, if you know, this show was canceled tomorrow, how do I get to keep doing it?
Yeah.
How do I get to do the next thing that allows me to be in the room, to have these amazing conversations, or to be able to photograph these people, or to make films about them, or whatever it is? How do I keep the steps going? So I think I define success and failure by that, by really wanting to make things that hold my interest and excite me without having to feel like I'm just a gun for hire.
But I think that what's really encouraging though is that definition of the balance of doing it at a level where you can have a good life, you can pay for your kids to go to school and get the creative satisfaction. And I would agree, that's the right definition of success. It's not to have $200 million in the
no.
bank or to be the number one on the star meter, whatever. It's, I want to keep doing what I'm really interested in, but also be able to have a life. The second question, having it be portraits or interviews or whatever, you've crossed another lane, if in some way this metaphor can have a three-lane highway, but which is you've got
there's a metro lane down
yeah,
the middle.
Exactly. You're in the carpool lane is you've come a little bit to the media side. And you've come to, and when I say media, I mean like the PR, reporters, where, you know, that can be, because you're friends with these people and you shoot these people and you do other stuff. And then if you're all of a sudden on the person on the outside who's commenting or critiquing, now having sat in that chair and been interviewed, I don't think you do that. I think you're very conscious of, you're letting me talk and you're asking me questions, but it's not, you know, tell me about your divorce or whatever.
Right.
It's, you know, this, but I do.
You had a good marriage.
I do. It's not my divorce. But what I mean is, have you also thought about sort of in doing portraits? And I like that analogy we've come up with as an umbrella for some of this work is, I feel portraits is probably the safest reporter, media, PR role that you can be in.
Right.
But do you think about that, the switching sides to sort of becoming?
You know, I do and I don't, because I feel like, first off, my history is, I started out full media because I was a photojournalist for the Associated Press. So when I was 21 years old, gosh, I was at Hank Gather's funeral, who was a basketball star for Loyola Marymount, who died on the court. And I'm there and I have to get like a picture of his mother, and I'm sure that I'm the last person she wants to see. And
right.
that's actually what made me quit. In fact, that very day, I think, was a big contributor of me not wanting to be a part of that. But I think that, you know, even when you're a photographer for Vanity Fair magazine, there are expectations on both sides.
Right.
The magazine wants a certain kind of picture. The person who comes in, the actor, hopes they're portrayed in a certain way.
Right.
And it's a negotiation, and it's a conversation. And I just hope that off camera and just my own personal agenda can erase those lines a little bit, because I plan on directing more films and doing more things where I'm the talent, as right. even more so than I may be seen in this off camera thing. But, you know, we've talked about this. I think that I'm in this kind of interesting position, because I do feel like I have one foot in each side,
right.
and I can talk to these people. I can talk to Judd Apatow about directing, and I can have a really expert, quote unquote, conversation
yeah.
about directing.
Yeah.
But hopefully I have enough understanding also on the other side of it that someone who's watching can feel a part of the conversation, because
yeah.
I'm on that other side too. But yeah, I think about that a lot, and sometimes I wonder if there's some subtle shift that occurs in someone's mind if they're sitting down to have a conversation
right.
with me. And the way I kind of calm myself down about that anxiety, because it is a little bit, you know, is I just say that anyone who bothers to get to know me is going to understand that I'm going to try different things.
Right.
And whatever I do next, it's going to be something I haven't done before. So I sort of figure it's the same principle of if I want to make something cool, I'm probably going to have to figure out how to do it on my own anyway.
Yeah.
And I'll hopefully change people's perceptions along the way if they had any to begin with.
Hey folks, today's sponsor is Casper Mattresses, obsessively engineered, American-made mattresses at a shockingly fair price. And now, you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/offcamera and using the code offcamera. Listen, the truth is you spend about a third of your life sleeping, so let's make sure you're doing it on a good mattress. Casper brings together two comfy technologies, latex foam and memory foam, for a better night's sleep. They've got just the right sink and just the right bounce, no matter how you sleep. And you've got to love the age of the internet that we're living in, because Casper Mattresses has the most amazing risk-free trial and return policy. They'll bring the mattress straight to your house, and you can try it for 100 days. That's right, 100 days. And if you're not happy, they'll pick it back up. So what do you have to lose? You go to a mattress store, you get maybe a minute to lay on the mattress. But with Casper, you'll actually get to sleep on it for like a third of a year. It's $500 for a twin-size mattress and $950 for a king-size mattress. Comparing that to industry averages, that's an outstanding price point. So get $50 off any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/offcamera and using the code offcamera. Terms and conditions apply.
One of the things we've discussed off camera, but we also talked a little bit when I was in that chair, in on camera, in off camera, was...
No one knows what we're talking about at this point.
I think they'll get it. I think we can make a funny game out of it. If you understood what they were talking about,
drink.
You win $50. Yeah, exactly. Drink. It'll be a drinking game. How many times did Chris or Sam say off camera? But what I was talking about was marketing. So
yeah.
I shared in my interview that my big frustration with the entertainment business right now as a whole is that, in all honesty, we're making too much stuff. And we're not self-editing each other, and the business isn't editing itself. It's exploding because all these people want original content. I mean, there was a FX, the television network, published yesterday a study that 429, I think it was 429 or maybe 409, I'm not remembering exactly, but something over 400 original scripted television shows were released in 2015. Now there isn't a chance on earth a human could possibly even be aware that all 400 got made, let alone make an educated decision on which ones they wanted to watch or find. And that's just one genre. There's reality shows, there's movies, there's documentaries. So I think that we're oversaturating it. I think when you make something good that's having a life, like off camera, right? you struggle. I know I do when I make a movie or I work on something where I'm just like, God, I made something good. It felt like when we made Good Will Hunting or I made American Pie, it was a shitload easier to get people to know it was happening, right? Like just to be like, hey, you might like this, right? Today, I feel like if I made either of those two movies, 50-50 shot, anyone ever heard of them.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And it freaks me out. So you're starting something new in a in an interview type format and you're creating this brand and you're doing this thing and you're got a podcast and you have the Hard Magazine as you described. What efforts and how are you working? Because as you said, I hope it gets bigger and I hope it does other stuff. And you admitted early in one of your answers, it's hard. You want people to figure it out. Or some people walk in here, never heard of it, right?
Yeah.
To me, that's the funniest thing is that PR people are sending people into places that they've never heard of to do interviews just because they have no idea of where the eyeballs are, right? So it's all of that. But have you guys spent time and you yourself thinking about and looking at how are we going to get people to fly us? Because here's the one thing I would say, and this is a long way of answering, this is your risk of getting me to come be in this chair, is I'll talk too much. What I'll say is that you said earlier that there's this sort of group of people who will like it and who will go into it and then they'll learn about it slowly and your definition of success and people trusting you when we were talking about the media thing. What immediately detracts me from something in the media side or whatever is when I realize the person's sole goal is to get more eyeballs no matter what, or to make more money no matter what, or to go out and just shill for whatever it is they're doing no matter what. And I think what I like about Off Camera, and also the guests you bring, is that there is at some level this self-imposed discipline of, look, I'm making something cool. I am cool, theoretically. I'm doing something cool. This project I'm trying to talk to you about, I'm gonna do either way, and as Ethan Hawke said, and I may get destroyed for it, or people may be angry because I switched lanes. And I would say that once you hit that line of crossing it to where I'm just trying to get more eyeballs, or I'm trying to do the fancy thing to get lots of people on BuzzFeed, or I'm trying to do whatever, you lose some of that. But that seems to be the way marketing is working today. If I can just get more likes, if I can just go out and get more followers, and you could, every time you have a famous person, say, okay, give me one piece of gossip so that I can make that my short little piece that I put out on Twitter. Everybody's like, holy shit, so-and-so said whatever, and that's your trade. And you don't, at least in the ones I've read and listened to and the one you do with me, not that I have any gossip, but my point is, that's where I think there's a weird line, and you guys hold the line very strongly. But in the marketing question of sort of, have you thought of going over that line or the TMZ line?
It's so funny. Crawford, being the business partner that he is, right, has his jaw sometimes hits the floor when we get offered somebody, and I say, no, I don't. But I really have to think, can I have a good conversation with that person? Do I have a genuine interest? And sometimes it's a challenge to go find out if I do. And other times it's just like, it's not true to me. So on the guest standpoint, yeah, we hold the line there.
Right.
I mean, the thing that all shows like this want is that no matter who's on, you tune in because you know you're going to hear something interesting.
Yeah.
And whenever I'm feeling weird about that, like, how do I market this? We don't have any advertising budget. We're not spending money. We're not running ads. I go, if I just stick at this long enough and I work really hard at it to get better at these conversations, it will eventually find its audience and it will be better because of it and it'll have a stronger core because of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's a struggle because we're incredibly fortunate. We're on television. We get seen by a lot of people. We're in 30 million homes on DirecTV. We have a lot of podcast listeners. And we just hope that if someone really likes it, they tell people about it.
I'm sort of getting to the end of what I had to talk about. There's one more thing that I just want to hit is one of the things we've talked about, one of the sort of buzzwords, and you take very little credit for this, so I'm going to ask it because you don't. I believe that the future, both for this marketing reason, but also because of this, we just have too much content out there, is going to be some level of curation, that all of us are going to, at some point, trust some other person who is, the sort of geek of some subject that you're interested in. I would argue that you, and you don't call yourself a curator, you don't say I'm curating, but I think the function you're serving of questions you're asking, of the people you're choosing in off camera to talk about, even in your documentaries and I'd love to hear, you know, sort of A, whether you accept that analogy that you're being a curator, but also why you may not want people to think of you that way, or why you do want people to think of you that way, and could you give us a little bit of what are those things that make someone interesting for you in the role of a curator?
Well, that's interesting because one of the things we're still trying to solve and trying to figure out a way to take advantage of is that there is a tremendous amount of information that I gather before I sit down with somebody.
Right.
Just anecdotally, even if I watch a YouTube video about someone I'm about to interview and they mention something offhand, and then I say, I haven't heard of that, and then I go check it out because it may lead to a question that they haven't heard 1,000 times.
Right.
It's almost like I want either a companion piece or a second podcast or something to
right.
just go down these avenues that are a little more, I guess on the surface, curatorial, but they're really just taking your curiosity and following it further down.
Right.
You know, it's almost like the idea of a living document, and you know, in the future, I would hope that maybe we could even turn the magazine into something where anything that was mentioned, you could just touch it and have more of an expanded view.
Yeah.
Like, I think that there is a value to that. I think when you've spent your life reading and listening to music and watching movies and discovering weird hobbies and traveling and eating certain kinds of food, that you want to share that stuff because you want to have that experience with somebody. You want to see someone's eyes light up after you give them a book and they come back to you a week later.
Right.
You know, that's to me the best part about sharing anything in life is that feeling that, oh, we both understand something.
Right.
You know, and I think this particular show puts me in a position where people do sort of trust me in some ways.
I agree. Yeah.
And I don't know, it's a fun thing to figure out, I guess. As funny as this is, being here 3 years and doing this for a relatively long time, I feel like we're so much at the beginning and the show's gonna get so much better the more I do it, and the more I feel like we don't have to prove ourselves anymore,
right.
Then we don't have to always reach out for the guest that is the biggest. You know, I love the fact that we can mix in people that people haven't heard of.
I agree.
And I want to do that more.
I had one last question.
Yes.
Just your classic interview thing. So you're getting to do an interview, you're talking about it, somebody might see it. Are there 2-3 guests that you would love to have on the show that you haven't been able to get on the show?
There are. There are definitely, from my personal life, I would love to have someone like Paul Westerberg on, who's a famous sort of musical recluse, but I think he's a great underrated songwriter that I think would be fascinating to have a conversation with. He was the singer of The Replacements.
Yeah.
And they were a band that I really liked growing up. So having him on would be great. I've had some of my heroes on. I had Stacy Peralta, the skateboarder, on, who I used to actually pretend to be when I was a young skater. So that was something interesting. I would love to have some of my favorite authors on that maybe no one would care about, but to have Jim Harrison on could be just a disaster because,
right.
You know, these writers, I think I love them because they are giant messes of people. but someone like that would be fantastic. And I would love to talk to an athlete who I think is as much of an artist as people we think of as an artist, like Clayton Kershaw, the pitcher for the Dodgers, that I think, you know, to get in the mind that far of a major league batter and be able to strike him out in such a silly way and throw a curveball that if it was simply an athletic event, then people could duplicate it.
Right.
But I think there has to be creative qualities to it. And to be able to talk to an athlete like just as a craftsman or an artist, that's exciting to me.
See, that's a very diverse group. And I think that's part of, as hopefully this interview helps people learn to trust you more and want to come back to the show because you're on it, not just because whoever the guest is.
Right.
Learning more about you, I think, you know, is interesting.
Well, listen, I appreciate you doing this for me because if there's anyone that ever was going to do this, it's you, because I feel like since the beginning, I brought this show idea to you. I talked it through with you. I know that you've been in a room 1,000 times with networks and pitching things, and you've been somewhat of a mentor to me.
Well, that's strong. But
no, you've definitely been a sounding board. And
I'm happy to do it.
And a friend, and you know, I am a bit uncomfortable talking this much about myself, and so
I think you did it pretty well.
Thank you very much.
Hey folks, that's our show for this time. A big thank you to Chris Moore for playing the role of me and for coming up with all those great topics. You know, we've now made 53 episodes, and as most of you know, we're also a television show, which you can see by tuning into the Audience Network on DirecTV. And if you don't have DirecTV, you can also watch the shows on our website at offcamera.com. But speaking of our television show, we've just been picked up for 30 more episodes, so you can count on a lot more off-camera conversations in 2016. We will be taking a short break this month, and we'll be back with new episodes in March. I'm very excited about our guest lineup for 2016, by the way. And I want to thank you, the listeners, for supporting the show and spreading the word about off-camera. We do not have an advertising or marketing department, so we depend on word of mouth from you. If you love what we're doing here, please, don't keep it a secret. Tell your friends and enemies about Off Camera so we can keep bringing you these conversations. And if you haven't done so, take a moment and visit the Off Camera store and show your love by ordering a magazine or 12. A subscription makes a great gift and it will class up any coffee table out there. So check that out. It's at offcamera.com. Click on the store and poke around a bit. And since we are at a bit of a break here, I want to take a moment and give credit to the Off Camera staff. It takes a lot of effort to put out a podcast, a television show, and a magazine, and I couldn't do it without these fine people. Crawford Shippey, our producer and COO, who keeps this whole thing afloat. Nathan Shields, who is a lot more than just the assistant to the traveling secretary. He also produces and edits and handles most of our post-production. Amy Jones, our researcher and writer, who makes us keep our literary standards high and our dictionaries handy. And Tyler Rumpf, the new father who operates 5 cameras. Kovan Sati and Linda Lichter, who deal with all the legal mumbo-jumbo. Susanna Kalb, who makes the operation run here in the office. And our newest member of the team, Michaela Galvin, who, although new, I am confident will be kicking ass and taking names with all graphics and layout work. And there's Kara Johnson, who turns the spoken word to the written word faster than the speeding bullet. There's Justin Kennedy, who knows more about clothes than any man should and makes everyone look good. And Kristen Heitkotter, our resident beautifier. Then there's Matt Davidson, who we love for his set expertise, and Albert Fu, Brian Carter, Brian Elioff, and Rob Epifano for excellence in photography assisting. And last but definitely not least, Bart Peters, Chris Long, and Heather Davis at DirecTV, who make us legitimate, 4K, and nationwide. Thanks for supporting the show. I'll see you soon, off camera.